Professor Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, barrister at law, and we're discussing Nuremberg, positivism, and human rights. When the word positivism is mentioned, it suggests legal philosophy. And when legal philosophy is mentioned, the tendency is for people to fall suddenly asleep. There is an urge to yawn. But this short talk should demonstrate the great relevance of issues of legal philosophy. I might add that I gave a talk somewhat along this line just a short time ago at my club, the Athenaeum, and if it's possible to keep my fellow members of the Athenaeum awake in dealing with legal philosophy, then surely those who are tuned to this program will have not the slightest difficulty. Positivism has been the prevailing legal philosophy in the common law world since the mid-19th century. By the common law world, of course, I refer to England, America, Commonwealth, and former Commonwealth countries, all of those influenced by the English common law. And indeed, positivism has had a staggering influence on the European continent as well, in the civil law world, in those countries where the legal system derives largely from the Napoleonic Code, countries such as France, Italy, Germany, Spain, etc. Sometimes legal positivism is called realism, legal realism. There are slight differences between the two, but we won't go into such detail. Let's first talk about legal positivism in the common law world. It originated in England, and the names associated with it, John Austin and Jeremy Bentham. John Austin wrote a work entitled The Province of Jurisprudence, Determined. This work was not published during his lifetime. He had a very devoted wife, and after he died quite young, his wife, his widow, spent the rest of her life editing his papers, and really his name became known through her work. If you're planning to be married, you should be sure to get a wife of that sort. John Austin argued that law is simply the commands of the sovereign. The commands of the sovereign. This is the command theory of law. If the sovereign commands it, that's law, period. You can't judge law from any external standpoint. Now, that didn't mean that Austin was an absolute monarchist. The sovereign could be the head of the state in any type of system. Thus, in England, you have the rule of the king in parliament, or the queen in parliament. That means that you have a parliamentary democracy. In the United States, the sovereign consists of the constitutionally established form of government there. In an aristocracy, the sovereign would be those who consider themselves or considered by others the best. Anyway, the point that Austin is making is that whatever the form of government, whatever the political system, once it establishes that something is law, you can't question it. If it looks like law and smells like law and tastes like law, it's law, period. Up until fairly recent years, it was thought that Austin's view that law is nothing but the commands of the sovereign was the source of modern legal positivism. We now know that it's more complicated than that. Actually, Austin got many of his ideas from Jeremy Bentham. Bentham, the utilitarian philosopher, made the mistake of not publishing a great deal when he could have done so. He wrote a vast amount of manuscript material, he gave a vast number of lectures, but he was not active in getting his ideas published quickly. Well, the problem when you do that is that other people may pick up your ideas and publish them as your own, as their own. And in the case of Bentham, he actually influenced Austin, and Austin's Province of Jurisprudence Determined was published before the works of Bentham, which actually were the source of many of these ideas. Bentham had what we might call diarrhea of the pen, but it didn't extend to publication during the years immediately after his writing the material. Bentham then had probably more influence on the rise of legal positivism in reality than did John Austin. Bentham was a fascinating person. He was a law reformer, a prison reformer. He designed a circular prison, for example, so that you could have a smaller number of guards in the center watching a greater number of prisoners, a very efficient sort of operation. He had some fairly bizarre utilitarian ideas, though. One of his ideas was that you should put to use the corpses of famous men. You don't want to just let these deteriorate in the ground. They could be utilitarian. They could be useful to future generations. So Bentham actually recommended that we stuff the bodies of famous people and we set them up in public places as a model for the next generation. Luckily for undertakers and for the rest of us, that was not put into practice, with one exception, Bentham himself. If you'd like to see Bentham, you go to University College London. Bentham willed himself to University College London. He was stuffed, and he is in a seated position in a glass case. Now, unfortunately, the embalming was not entirely successful where the head was concerned. So they had to do a wax head, and the original skull, in rather poor shape, is beneath his feet. And we understand that he is rolled out at certain board meetings. I cannot verify that, but in any case, we have the problem of an unqualified and perhaps naive utilitarian philosophy. The situation in America with regard to the command theory was simply this, that since Americans don't talk about a sovereign in quite the same way as the English do, this was modified by such legal scholars as John Chipman Gray. Gray talked about the decision of judges. The decision of judges is final. You can't say anything beyond that as far as the validity of the law. Someone has said that in the case of the Supreme Court of the United States, they are not final, their decisions are not final because they're right. They're right because they're final. And that is exactly the position of legal positivism. On the European continent, the position was often called legal realism, but it amounted to the same thing. And it coordinated in the 19th century with the growth of scientific positivism. If a thing, you know, looks like a tree toad, smells like a tree toad and tastes like a tree toad, and you think it's an antelope, the burden of proof rests on you. Things are simply the way they appear to be. That's the positivist code. And Auguste Comte, the founder of sociological positivism, took exactly that view. The idea was to measure things, to examine them, to boil them over a low flame, and lo and behold, their character would be immediately evident and you couldn't raise larger philosophical issues. In our century, legal positivism has had some powerful representatives. On the European continent, Hans Kelsen. Kelsen, who in the Second World War got out, went to the United States, fortunately. He was Austrian in origin, and he spent the last years of his life at the University of California. Hans Kelsen, the greatest continental representative of legal positivism. And in England, H.L.A. Hart, Herbert Hart, professor of jurisprudence at Oxford. It's important to listen to what these two gentlemen have to say about the nature of law, because this is going to have direct relevance to issues of human rights today. Let's begin with Hans Kelsen. In a lecture that he gave at the University of California, a lecture which was not published during his lifetime, he said this, and I quote, "It is of the greatest importance to be aware of the fact that there is not only one moral or political system, but at different times and within different societies, several very different moral and political systems are considered to be valid by men living under these normative systems. These systems actually came into existence by custom, or by commands of outstanding personalities like Moses, Jesus, or Muhammad. If men believe that these personalities are inspired by a transcendental supernatural, that is, a divine authority, the moral or political system has a religious character. It is especially in this case, when the moral or political system is supposed to be of divine origin, that the values constituted by it are considered to be absolute. If, however, and this is Kelsen's position, if, however, the fact is taken into consideration that there are, there were, and probably always will be several different moral and political systems actually presupposed to be valid within different societies, the values constituted by these systems can be considered to be only of a relative character. Then the judgment that a definite government or a definite legal order is just can be pronounced only with reference to one of the several different political and moral systems, and then the same behavior or the same governmental activity or the same legal order may, with reference to another moral or political system, be considered as morally bad or as politically unjust, unquote. You see what Kelsen is saying? He's saying moral and political systems and legal systems are like trains passing in the night. You don't have any absolute vantage point by which to judge them. You can only judge one from the standpoint of the other. And if one legal system, having the commands of that sovereign, thinks that there's something the matter with another legal system, well, that's their opinion. The other legal system can turn around and make the same sort of negative judgment in reverse. Kelsen talked about every legal system having its root norm, its foundational norm or foundational value. And he said, you can't criticize the ground norm of one system from the standpoint of another. H.L.A. Hart, an Englishman, was not inclined toward abstract expressions such as group norm that is very, very German. In fact, it makes one think of what Macaulay said after trying to read Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. He said, it's amazing in this day and age that one intelligent man cannot write so that another intelligent man can understand him. There's a tendency on the part of certain German philosophers to make obscurantism a high value. Anyway, H.L.A. Hart did not suffer from that particular problem. He is very, very clear, but he's saying the same sort of thing, essentially, as Kelsen. In H.L.A. Hart's great work, The Concept of Law, he says this, and I quote, "We only need the word validity, and commonly only use it, to answer questions which arise within a system of rules, where the status of a rule as a member of the system depends on its satisfying certain criteria provided by the rule of recognition." That is, the rule recognizes what goes into the system. "No such question can arise as to the validity of the very rule of recognition which provides the criteria. It can neither be valid nor invalid, but is simply accepted as appropriate for use in this way." Hart used the analogy of the meter bar in Paris. Let's say that you study with me in France. I teach human rights every summer in Strasbourg. Let's say that you're studying with me and you go to a quincaillerie, that's a hardware store, and you buy a meter stick, like a yardstick. And then the thought occurs to you, have they cheated me, those wretched French? Is it possible that this meter stick is not the right length? Well, the only way to find out is to get on the Rapide and go to Paris and go to the Bureau of Standards, and there you can compare your meter stick with the standard meter bar. Now, says Hart, there's nothing the matter with doing that. That's like looking within a legal system to see if the parts of it fit. But you can't ask, does the basic rule of recognition of the system fit? Fit what? That's the starting point. This would be like going to the Bureau of Measures, and after you'd measured your meter stick, you'd say to the fellow there, person in charge, but how do I know that the standard meter bar is the right length? And of course he would say, les Anglais, ils sont fous. Englishmen are nuts, because you can't even ask that question about the standard. You see, Hart is saying the same thing as Kelsen. Each legal system is a law unto itself. You can't judge it from the outside. Well, that seems very interesting in an abstract sort of way, but then comes the Second World War. And nasty rumors arise to the effect that hideous atrocities are being committed by the Nazis. concentration camps, people taken away because of their racial position, tortured, killed, their property removed, all of this done to them. And at the end of the Second World War, the evidence was far worse than anyone had imagined. And of course, the war crimes trials took place at Nuremberg. The Nazis were put on trial. What did the Nazis have to say? Well, the Nazis were perfect legal positivists. The Nazis said, ah, the only reason we're on trial is because we lost and you won. We simply followed out the legal system that we had. You're trying to judge our legal system from outside. You mustn't do that. We were consistent in our legal system. Our legal system happened to be Aryan. It happened to be racist. We did not consider Jews to be human beings on the same level as others, and therefore we did not give them the same legal protections. But that was our system. And here we are on trial simply because we lost. Notice the problem that this created for the prosecution at Nuremberg. Let me read you part of Justice Jackson's closing argument for the prosecution at Nuremberg. Justice Jackson was an associate justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, and this is one of the great arguments at Nuremberg. I quote, "It is common to think of our own time as standing at the apex of civilization, from which the deficiencies of preceding ages may patronizingly be viewed in the light of what is assumed to be progress." And he puts it in quotation marks. "The reality is that in the long perspective of history, the present century will not hold an admirable position unless its second half is to redeem its first. These 20 years in this 20th century will be recorded in the book of years as one of the most bloody in all annals. 2 world wars have left a legacy of dead which number more than all the armies engaged in any war that made ancient or medieval history. No half century ever witnessed slaughter on such a scale, such cruelties and inhumanities, such wholesale deportations of people into slavery, such annihilations of minorities. The terror of Torquemada pales before the Nazi Inquisition. These deeds are the overshadowing historical facts by which generations to come will remember this decade. If we cannot eliminate the causes and prevent the repetition of these barbaric events, it is not an irresponsible prophecy to say that this 20th century may yet succeed in bringing the doom of civilization." And parenthetically, the second half of the 20th century has simply revealed that even worse things were done by Stalin in Soviet Russia, by Amin Dada in Uganda, by the Serbs in Eastern Europe, etc. In any case, Jackson continues, "Goaded by these facts, we have moved to redress the blight on the record of our era. At this stage of the proceedings, I rest upon the law of these crimes as laid down in the Charter of the International Military Tribunal. This charter is no part of the constitutional mechanism of internal justice of any of the signatory nations. It wasn't part of French law, English law, American law, Russian law. As an international military tribunal, it rises above the provincial and transient and seeks guidance not only from international law, but also from the basic principles of jurisprudence, which are the assumptions of civilization." What's Jackson saying there? He's saying we've got to go deeper or higher. We've got to go beyond individual legal systems. We've got to find somehow the assumptions of civilization, the basic principles of jurisprudence, which constitute the assumptions of civilization. He says we're judging at Nuremberg not on the basis of a positivistic national law. We're judging on the basis of something far deeper, far higher. Well, did this satisfy the defendants? Certainly not. The defendants, Goering and company, simply took the view that what the prosecution was calling the assumptions of civilization were reflections of their own legal systems anyway. Well, as a result of the Nuremberg trials, positivism has fallen on very hard times. In the aftermath of the Nuremberg trials, the Universal Declaration on Human Rights was set forth. The European Human Rights System with the European Convention on Human Rights was established, that in 1950. And now we realize that we've got to go beyond individual legal systems in order to arrive at human rights standards. Of course, the $64,000 or 64,000 pound question still remains. Where do you get those principles, pray tell? Where do you find inalienable rights, rights that cannot be, must not be alienated? If human beings create the rights, presumably human beings can always take them away. So maybe we've got to look on a transcendent level to find our way. René Cassin, who was one of the most important authors of the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, said that he got the principles he put into the Universal Declaration from the Bible. Fascinating. You may not think that that's the way to go, but if you don't think it's the way to go, it behooves you to figure out some other way that will rise above the human situation, because water doesn't rise above its own level. Thank you.